Okay, we will go on the record and come to order. The commission is hereby convened in open session on Thursday, March 10th, 2016, to consider the matter entitled Secretary of Labor versus ICG Illinois LLC. Docket number Lake 2013-160. Present are myself, Commissioner Nakamura, Commissioner Young, Commissioner Cohen, and Commissioner Alton. Chairman Jordan cannot be present at the meeting today. We will start with an overview of the case presented by Tanya Wisnan. Good morning, Tanya.
Good morning. This matter involves a single citation issued for a violation of Section 75.1506C1, which requires that refuge alternatives be provided within 1,000 feet of the nearest working face. The only issues before the commission are the SNS and gravity determinations. The citation was issued on September 18, 2012, during an EO2 spot inspection of ICG Illinois' Viper Mine. MSHA Inspector Dennis Baum noticed an entry in the examination books stating that the refuge alternative needed to be moved closer to the working face. When he traveled underground, he found that the refuge had not yet been moved and was located 1,110 feet from the face, 110 feet beyond the allowable maximum. He issued a citation and determined that the condition was the result of high negligence, was significant and substantial, and was reasonably likely to result in fatalities for the 17 miners working on the face. Regarding his gravity determinations, Baum testified that the mine had a history of methane and ignition problems, and that refuges are only intended for use in worst-case scenarios where escape is impossible, such as roof falls, fires, or explosions. He stated that the extra 110 feet of travel would be significant in such situations, when visibility is poor and miners are injured or disoriented, and any injuries would be fatal because it was unlikely that miners would be able to reach the refuge in the event of an explosion. He also testified that he would consider any violation of this standard at this mine to be SNS, and that he believed even the 1,000-foot allowable maximum to be unsafe. The judge affirmed the SNS and gravity determinations, reduced the negligence to moderate, and reduced the penalty. In his Matthews analysis, the judge found that the possibility of miners being delayed or prevented from reaching the refuge in an emergency as a result of the extra distance constituted a hazard, and that the mine's history of methane and ignition issues and the presence of ignition sources contributed to a likelihood of an ignition or explosion, which would result in poor visibility and disorientation, creating the likelihood of serious injury for the 17 miners on the section. The judge rejected ICG's claim that the presence of self-contained self-rescuers mitigated the gravity, noting that refuges are only intended for use when escape is impossible and that SCSRs do not protect against burns, falling rock, or disorientation. ICG contests the judge's SNS and gravity findings. As a legal matter, ICG claims that the judge misapplied the third Matthews factor by finding a mere possibility of injury based on a string of worst-case events rather than a reasonable likelihood. ICG also claims that the judge erred by not finding the presence of SCSRs to be mitigating, since the SCSRs would have provided enough air to travel the extra 110 feet, reducing the likelihood of injury. As a factual matter, ICG argues that the SNS finding is not supported by substantial evidence, that nothing in the record except the inspector's opinion supports a determination that having to travel an extra 110 feet would result in fatal injuries. Generally, ICG suggests that finding a likelihood of serious or fatal injury in this instance would essentially amount to an improper determination that all violations of the standard are per se SNS. The secretary counters that the judge found more than a mere possibility of injury, and rather that he identified a number of intervening events which could reasonably occur. With regard to the self-rescuers, the secretary cites Buck Creek for the proposition that the presence of other safety measures does not mitigate the SNS nature of a violation. As to the substantial evidence issue, the secretary claims the Baum's testimony, based on his experience, is sufficient. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? Thank you, Tanya. I believe Commissioner Young has agreed to go first.
Thanks, Commissioner Nakamura, and thank you very much, Tanya, for the excellent memo and analysis in this case. This case has a sparse record, which somehow made it more difficult to decide. Looking at it, I think we come down to some basic elemental questions, because they're drawn into sharp focus by the peculiar facts and this sparse, though not entirely absent, evidentiary support for the Secretary's theory that this was SNS. When you look at what those words mean, significant and substantial, I mean, just in ordinary use, they seem to suggest meaningful and real. I have a difficult time looking at something and saying 10% or 11% of something is not meaningful or real. I think that we encounter this in our daily lives and consider a 10% variance, you know, to be something substantial, something significant. If you were to get a 10% pay raise, I think everyone would be pretty happy with that. If someone gave you a 10% pay cut, I think you'd be pretty unhappy. 10% off. That's a common sale tactic. I don't know how you can really properly consider that in the context of this case and the traditional Matthies analysis. As I've noted, the evidence here is weak, but it's not entirely absent. You have an inspector who discusses the circumstances of this mine, a gassy mine that was on spot inspection. And he believed, based on his experience, that any violation here should be S&S, that even the 1,000 feet contained in the standard is too far to expect miners to travel on the conditions in this mine. He discussed very tersely, but he did discuss the difficulties arising from smoke, fatigue, disorientation, and somewhat compellingly about the conditions that you'd likely confront in this scenario. And when the operator talks about this being a speculative exercise and considering a worst-case scenario, that's the scenario that the standard presents us with and compels us to analyze, because it's not just a mine disaster in some form. You have to assume, before you ever get to a refuge scenario, that you cannot use either the primary or secondary escape way, because every person who's ever testified on this issue will tell you, and every person who's ever worked in a mine, the best option is escape. If you have that option available, you take it. So we're asked in this case really to stand in the boots of the miners in this situation. And 10% really isn't a linear progression in this scenario. The 10% is extra after you've already gone 1,000 feet in a mine disaster situation where there is likely to be smoke and likely to be confusion and disorientation, where there's a significant possibility, if not an absolute likelihood, of injuries to miners and injured miners who must be cared for and carried. In that situation, it's very difficult to say that an additional distance of some type would not be significant or substantial, would not create a burden that would be too much to bear at some point. If we had this record and you had a 500-foot variance, would that be too much? Would you say, well, that's significant and substantial, it's half again? What if it was twice as much, if it's 2,000 feet? What if it's 40 feet? It's difficult to decide that for every case here. Part of the problem is, I think, that the standard the Secretary has set up uses one of those permissibly arbitrary standards that administrative law throws at you. You know, there's nothing magical about 1,000 feet. The Secretary didn't bring in scientists to say, at 1,000 feet, your air runs out. At 1,000 feet, you know, the rubble will just be too much to traverse. Nobody said that. They decided they had to set a distance, and they set a distance. In this case, the inspector testified he thought 1,000 feet was too far in this mine. So 1,001 feet to him would obviously be too far. But for our purposes, the other thing we run into is the traditional Matthies analysis. And it's hard to say 1,001 feet is the difference between compliance with the standard and no significant and substantial risk of serious injury or death, and a significant and substantial violation, a likelihood, a reasonable likelihood that minors would suffer serious injuries or die if there were this kind of mine-wide disaster. I'm not sure the best way to approach this, but as myself personally, I considered this and wondered whether it might be useful if we set up something like a rebuttable presumption and set 10% as the baseline. I acknowledge this is somewhat radical. It's something we haven't done. But I'm leery of setting up something that establishes a per se violation for several reasons. When you say something is per se S&S, if you're even a foot over, it just doesn't seem logical. You know there's a point out there where it's a problem, where it may be too great. And nobody here wants to see any situation, you know, where minors are killed or perhaps disabled because they couldn't get to a refuge. But you really, really don't want to see it where the refuge was 50 feet away and you know, where they were forced to try and barricade themselves at 1,050 feet away from a refuge that was too far. And when the law gives you a hand like that, you have to do the best you can do. If you had a rebuttable presumption, an operator could say, under the circumstances of this particular mine, 100 feet is not too far because we've taken these other additional measures. And I don't mean the SCSRs, which were required by the changes brought about in response to the Sago and Aracoma disasters. But I'm talking about actual things that might proactively make escape more likely. And I think we've seen some of these. We had a case previously where an operator talked about measures that had taken to make escape more likely and more feasible under that scenario. And I think that's something that might be considered appropriately in that situation, determining whether a 10% variance was in fact S&S. Similarly, the secretary could talk about, you know, the difference between 100 feet, you know, down an entry, which is the same as the previous 1,000 feet, and 100 feet passing, or 40 feet even, or 30 feet passing through an intersection with complicated interchanges of lifelines, with decisions that have to be made in the heat of a crisis scenario, and make a case that under the facts as established by the secretary, it would be S&S despite it not being 10%. I'm throwing that out there for discussion, having not committed myself even to accepting that. Matthews presents us with what I consider to be a useful fiction, this concept of reasonable likelihood. And we all know that, and we're all grateful for the fact that there's no real reasonable likelihood that there's going to be a disaster in any given mine, that there's going to be an explosion, that there's going to be an electrical arc that ignites dust. But we also know from cruel and bitter experience that there is a possibility and that it will happen somewhere at some point. And you know, what we have to do is to erect standards and author decisions that clarify the law such that operators remember that it's their responsibility to provide a safe and healthful workplace for their employees. And just based on the record in this case, I the evidence is so thin. If you look at it in the traditional particular circumstances analysis that we apply in these situations to try and figure out what was really considered against the definition of the hazard, and I think the judge got it approximately right on that it's not. It's not the danger of not being escaped in a gross sense. It's the marginal increase in the danger between 1,000 feet and 1,110 feet or 1,125 feet, whatever it was, that these miners may have encountered. You know, that's the hazard. And it's hard to say in this situation that distance would certainly be crucial, but it's hard for me personally to believe that a distance of greater than 100 feet would be insignificant or insubstantial. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Young. Commissioner Oliphant.
Thank you, Acting Chairman McNamara. Well, in some respects, Commissioner Young and I are in complete agreement on this case because actually I think this is a burden of proof case. You mentioned rebuttable presumption. I'm not sure exactly how that worked, but the Secretary always bears the burden of proof of showing that the violation is significant and substantial. I don't think that burden can be shifted to the operator to show it's not significant and substantial. So in this case, skipping Matthes for a second and going all the way back to National Gypsum, which I now prefer to Matthes, easy to apply. In this case, the Secretary must show, based upon the particular facts surrounding the violation, there exists a reasonable likelihood that the hazard contributed to will result in an injury or illness of a reasonably serious nature. That's the Gypsum test. So for me, the first question was, is the refuge chamber of more than 1,000 feet inherently a significant and substantial violation? In other words, sort of the inspector's view. 1 foot makes it a significant and substantial violation. I think the answer to that question has to be no. NIOSH recommended 1,000 to 2,000 feet. I don't think the International Institute of Occupational Safety and Health would have recommended a distance that would be inherently a significant and substantial risk of serious bodily injury. Actually, I think it ultimately came down and said time was more appropriate than a specific distance and came up with 30 minutes. Tanya, by the way, thank you for your very good memo, but it reminds me that when I got Tanya's memo, I alerted her to a great Tennessee Williams play, The Glass Menagerie, with the famous monologue at the end where time is the longest distance between two places. It's a fabulous, if you haven't seen it, watch the play.
It's been a long time.
It's been a long time, but it's good. Anyway, but I've been a long time too. Anyway, so in that regard, they said 30 minutes. Now, there are calculations that they also include and are included in multiple places in MSHA's literature, is that that it would take to go 1,100 feet crawling, that is with lower than 40-inch coal, would take about 15 minutes. So the extra 100 feet, if you were crawling, would take about 80 seconds. If it's linear. I didn't see any testimony that it's not linear here. That's where we're going.
So did you ever crawl 1,000 feet?
Huh?
Go ahead. Sorry.
I think my wife made me do it once, but I'm not sure. Anyway, they said 30 minutes, which can clearly be traversed in 30 minutes, which clearly gets you 1,000 feet or 1,100 feet. The metal non-metal regulations, which I know we don't use metal non-metal for coal, because on danger it goes sort of the other way, metal. Make us interpret a coal standard, but it's 30 minutes in metal, not metal. So the refuge chamber has to be 30 minutes from the work site in the metal, not metal environment. Based on all this, I can't see any basis to find that an extra 110 feet creates inevitably a significant and substantial risk of reasonable likelihood of harm. So I don't think it is per se. Howard, so that brings us to the particular facts and circumstances of the case. What the Secretary did not show, although the inspector said, well, it's got a history of ignitions, they didn't show any ignitions there. He said that. I don't know that it's got a history other than he said that. There's no real evidence of a history of ignitions. There's no methane measurements near the working face. There's no seam heights. There's no travel impediments mentioned. There's no working blockages. We don't even know the height of the seam. Is this 8 feet or is it 40 inches? There's no mention of roof or rib problems. There's no the possibility of continued normal mining conditions doesn't exist because they were already in the process of moving it up when the citation was issued. There's no evidence that you had to go around corners or jump down hills or climb ropes or anything else. It just, as far as we know on this record, this is an 8-foot high seam with great roof, great ribs, great floor, with a straight out linear 1,110 feet. They don't show anything else, and that's their burden. So what, on that basis, they didn't show anything. Well, they showed something. By the way, I don't think I could go for a percentage kind of thing, because I'm not saying that a 50-foot would not be a significant substantial violation. If they showed that there was a, maybe you had to go around a corner at 1,040 feet, or that there was a pressure in the earth, or that there was a crack in the roof that might fall, I can certainly see myself sustaining a significant substantial for 1,040 feet if they showed the evidence. I'm just saying they didn't show the evidence here, except they did show some evidence. They showed the inspector, for what it's worth, which I think is practically nothing, said that he thought a significant substantial. Didn't show he was an expert on explosions, didn't show he had any particular training. This is just, I don't mean to diminish an inspector, this is just an inspector, given an unqualified, non-expert opinion. And to me, that doesn't carry very much weight. Now, I think for some of us, the fact that this was a methane-heavy mine will carry weight, and it certainly should be something that's carefully thought about. In the Upper Big Branch catastrophe, they actually had refuge chambers in place in compliance with the law. Tragically, nobody got there because the miners were all killed in the explosion. In his testimony, I don't have the citation here with me. The inspector seems to sort of accept that scenario too. He says almost like, well, if it's really an explosion, they're probably all dead. So he seems to diminish the possibility of refuge chamber helping anyone in an explosion. But I don't think we completely ignore it. However, what I think the problem is we would have to hypothesize a very specific, there's no evidence, by the way, that an explosion that there could exist an explosion that would not kill every miner, but yet would compel dust more than 1,000 feet down an intake airway. I mean, I don't know that there's such an explosion can be done. There's no evidence about it, no expert witness. So we have to hypothesize based upon our own ignorance the possibility of a very specific type of explosion that's never been shown by us to have possibly ever occurred. How can we do that? How has the government proved this case? I'd find the government didn't prove its case and reverse it.
Thank you, Commissioner Auckland. Commissioner Cullen?
There's a story. Well, let me thank Tanya first. That was a nice memo and gave me some nice help yesterday, some of which I'm going to refer to. There's the story about the three wise Indians asked
Native American
blind.
Yeah, be careful here.
No. Indian.
Okay.
Who are
this
blindfolded.
Is our new EEO director, by the way.
Or maybe blind, then asked to feel around an elephant and describe what it was. And one of the wise men felt around the trunk and came out with one thing, and to make this short, and one of them felt the tail and one of them felt a leg, and they all came out with totally different impressions of what this elephant was. And that seems to be what we're doing here, I think. Because I have a totally different take on it than Commissioner Alton. What a surprise. The refuge chamber requirement came about as a result of the Sago explosion, and Sago was an explosion where miners were cut off. by smoke and could not escape. And there was no refuge chamber, and they barricaded. They went to the furthest point away from the explosion they could get to and barricaded themselves in, and over a period of time suffocated. If there had been a refuge chamber out there, those miners would have survived.
Do you know the refuge chamber would have been within?
I don't know.
The detail. I mean, that you're supposing that.
Yeah, I could. I'm pretty sure it was. I mean, let me. I hadn't thought about that, but I could pull that together.
That'd be very interesting.
In fact, one of them did survive.
One of them
disabled,
did survive.
But I mean, yeah.
Oh, right. But because this is an intake airway, too. They're moving an intake airway, so the dust would, of course, an explosion, dust goes into an intake airway, but the natural flow of the air is to clear the dust back away from where they're going.
And you don't know what it does to the ventilation.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. It could disrupt the ventilation.
Yeah, it did disrupt the ventilation.
Yeah.
But these are all coulds. See, that's my problem.
Yeah, I know.
These are lots of little tiny coulds.
Yeah, okay. We, as both Commissioner Young and Commissioner Alton said, this is a sparse evidentiary record. And I think we can't underestimate. We've been struggling, certainly since during the 8 years I've been on the commission, and clearly from reading the cases before that, to define what SNS is and how you apply it. And at this point, March 2016, we cannot underestimate the importance of the Fourth Circuit's recent decision in Knox Creek. I think Knox Creek clarifies a lot of the confusion that has been surrounding SNS. My reading of Knox Creek is that it sheds light on at least four different points. One is the question of what must be shown in the third prong. Now, everybody assumed here that this was a third prong case. I don't think it is, and I'll talk about that. But Knox Creek argued that the violation must be shown to be reasonably likely to result in injury. In contrast, the court adopted what the commission said in Musser Engineering and what the secretary was arguing, which is that the third prong involves whether the hazard established in the second prong is reasonably likely to result in injury. And thus, for purposes of the third prong, you assume the existence of the hazard. Has to be proven in the second prong, but for purposes of the third prong, you assume its existence. The court noted that that's what other cases, what other courts have said, and noted that the commission has at least recently said that. The court then discussed that SNS involves both the concept of likelihood and the concept of gravity. And the court noted that this was present in both National Gypsum and Matthews. And by the way, in response to something Commissioner Alton said, it's clear to me that the test is Matthews. The courts are not going back and putting things in terms of National Gypsum. That's just not happening.
Probably not, but Matthews is so screwed up now that it's almost impossible to apply.
No, it's not.
There we differ.
And the Fourth Circuit is, and the Fourth Circuit has made it more possible to apply.
Maybe not. I've got some language from them here.
Um, The Fourth Circuit made a distinction in terms of likelihood and gravity and said that likelihood is the primary thing that's being considered in the second prong, while gravity is the primary thing being considered in the third and fourth prongs. And in doing that, the court discussed in some detail our decisions in the Black Beauty case and the Cumberland case. So the court, the Fourth Circuit derived, it seems to me, the where it was going from our cases. The court also addressed what has to be shown in the second prong. And with regard to the second prong, said that the violation must be, quote, at least somewhat likely to result in harm. And that was derived from Black Beauty and Cumberland, our cases. We pointed out in both of those cases circumstances where the particular violation may not contribute to a hazard if it's a kind of a de minimis violation. And I think that was the court really picked up on that in from both of those cases. And I think that was where they synthesized that to come up with the at least somewhat likely language. And fourth, the court addressed certain arguments made by the the operator in Knox Creek. One based on Texas Gulf, where the court said that yes, indeed, the particular facts are considered, contrary to what the operator was arguing, and in Ziegler Coal, Ziegler Coal was a commission case where the secretary was said to have to prove the reasonable likelihood of an ignition, and the commission in that case also said that the idea of could was not good enough. In Knox Creek, the Fourth Circuit said that we have essentially turned our back on Ziegler. I point out that Knox Creek is the fullest analysis of S&S by a federal appellate court. Fullest analysis that I'm aware of, that it's consistent with the Midwest, the Peabody Midwest mining case, which when we had it was a Black Beauty case, in which the Seventh Circuit described the standard for the second step of Matthews as could. And I think that the federal courts will be following Knox Creek, and that is what we're going to see as the law. I could be wrong, but I think that's where it's going. With that as background, we look at the facts of the case and the judge's decision, noting that the judge's decision was written a year before Knox Creek and before Seventh Circuit decision in Peabody Midwest Mining. Now, the judge, it seems to me that the key thing in these S&S cases is how you define the hazard. Because the hazard, both in the second step, has to have a contribution from the violation, and in the third and fourth steps, has to be reasonably likely to lead to serious injury, serious harm. So the definition of the hazard is critical. And
the judge was not entirely clear because he talked both of minors being incapable of reaching the refuge alternative, and he also used language about the distance resulting in additional delays in accessing the chamber. In thinking about what the hazard is in this case, you look to what the intent of the standard is. The intent of the standard is that minors be able to reach a refuge chamber in those very few catastrophic situations where they can't escape. That's the only reason for a refuge chamber. And as we all understand, minors are trained to get out of mine. Refuge chamber is the kind of the least worst alternative. It's better than barricading. But it's the place you go where you can't exit the mine. And that necessarily means that what has happened is monumentally bad. As the inspector testified, it would involve smoke. It would involve possible obstructions to the escape way. You don't look at the escape way in its pristine conditions before an explosion. You look at it where it's potentially full of rubble because of an explosion. And you consider the fact that miners may be injured and they may have a difficult time getting to the refuge chamber, and other miners may have a difficult time helping them, maybe carrying them to a refuge chamber. So I think that the hazard is an inability to reach the refuge chamber, and we need to look at it in those terms. The question under step two is whether the violation, here more than 1,000 feet, or 1,100, I mean, let's be clear, it's 1,100 feet. We could speculate endlessly about whether a violation of 1,010 feet or 1,001 feet, or on the other side, a violation of 1,500 feet or 2,000 feet is S&S. But ultimately that's meaningless, and ultimately we don't have to, because what we have here is a very specific violation where the refuge chamber was 1,100 feet. So we're looking at this additional 100 feet.
Your whole argument I'm sorry to interrupt you, but doesn't your whole argument seem to suggest a per se violation for going over 1,000 feet?
No, I don't know if it's a per se violation or not.
Because, I mean, setting the standard, they certainly, in setting the refuge chamber standard, took into account explosions and rough stuff, so when they set the 1,000 feet, they anticipated all of that, I assume.
I don't know.
You think NIOSH
maybe
didn't think about that stuff?
Well, speak about what NIOSH thought about. What we have here is 1,100 feet. It may or may not be per se. We don't know that. I'm not in a position to answer that yet. Let's see a few more cases, and then we can evaluate whether it's per se or not. This one's 1,100, and I think this one's S&S. Under a standard of at least somewhat likely from the Fourth Circuit, or a standard of could from the Seventh Circuit. I think that the facts here justify, and the Secretary has proven, that this violation would contribute to the hazard of an inability to reach the refuge chamber. And in this sense, the preamble, and here I'm grateful to Tanya, the preamble to the regulations is significant. It's a recent regulation, so there's some substance in the preamble. And as Commissioner Alton said, there was a question of what NIOSH would had said, 1,000 to 2,000 feet. And when it was originally proposed, it was 1,000 to 2,000 feet. Refuge alternatives be located between 1,000 feet and 2,000 feet from the working phase. But they got comments, and they reconsidered it. And based on that, MSHA came up with a standard of 1,000 feet and said regarding that, in the final rule, MSHA changed the location requirement based on testimony and comments regarding the inability of miners on the working section to travel over 1,000 feet through smoke and debris to reach the refuge alternative, especially if injured or exhausted. That, to me, is compelling. If it's over 1,000 feet, how far over, I don't know. And we'll, you know, we can see that come out. But at 1,100 feet, there's a hazard of inability to reach the refuge chamber. Now, third and fourth prongs, if you don't reach the refuge chamber, is it reasonably likely you're going to die or suffer permanent injury? Yes. I don't think anyone would disagree on that. And so I think it's S&S.
Thank you, Commissioner Cohen. Thank you, Tanya.
We haven't addressed the SCSRs, and I don't think they mitigate. I don't know if anyone...
Okay.
I'm not arguing.
Yeah, I'm not arguing. All right. Okay, thank you. And thank you, Tanya, for a fine memo again. I am not sure on whether I'm ready to adopt the test in Knox Creek without certainly more discussion and thought on that. On the other hand, I would affirm the judge based on the traditional Matthes test. What I'm concerned about is the possibility, and this was mentioned by the inspector several times, of injured and disabled miners needing to be transported by the other miners on the section out of the mine, either through the escapeways or to the refuge alternative if the escapeways are blocked. The regulations, you know, contemplate the possibility of there being injured or disabled miners in several other sections. In particular, when you're looking at the escapeway provision itself, 75-380, there are minimum height and width requirements for escapeways. They have to be generally 5 feet high, except in low coal. It can be lower than that. And the regs say that if there's a question of whether or not something is wide enough or tall enough, that MSHA can do a stretcher test, meaning you get four people and you put a miner on the stretcher and you see whether or not they can get through this escapeway. So the emergency provisions for escapeways themselves, you know, contemplate that there could be, and I think reasonably likely to be, an injured or disabled minor that has to be carried out in a stretcher. There are first aid training requirements, where every supervisor has to be trained in first aid, and first aid has to be training has to be available to all minors. So they learn about the it's required that supervisors know how to take care of disabled minors. So that certainly that provision contemplates that there could be injured or disabled minors in the event of a disaster in a coal mine. The first aid equipment, the regs set out the first equipment, it has to be within 500 feet of the face, so even closer than the refuge alternative. And the equipment has to include a stretcher and a broken backboard, which I guess is a little bit more firm, and arm and leg splints. So again, the provisions under the emergency preparedness provisions contemplate disabled or injured minors. As Commissioner Cohen pointed out in reading the provision from the passage from the preamble for the refuge alternatives, and I'll read it again. In the final rule, M should change the location requirement based on testimony and comments regarding the inability of miners on the working section to travel over 1,000 feet through smoke and debris to reach the refuge alternative, especially if injured or exhausted. So again, this provision contemplates the likelihood that there will be injured and disabled minors. Anecdotally, I can tell you that miners on the ground are not going to leave an injured miner back at the face. They're going to take them. The big tragedy in Alabama.
Or stay there themselves.
The one big tragedy in Alabama, Gibraltar's number 5 mine, there was one injured miner at the face. There had been an explosion. He was disabled. And 12 other miners traveled down to the face to get him out. But that's when the second explosion occurred, and they all got killed. So, I mean, that's a tragedy. They weren't able to get him out. But I think what illustrates is the mentality of coal miners, that they're not going to abandon their brother in the coal mine. So that's what makes me conclude that this is SNS. That 110 feet could be critical. Having to transport an injured minor slows you down. As everyone has pointed out, you've already traveled 1,000 feet. In Alabama, we use football analogies, so right, that's more than 3 football fields, plus another 100, plus another 220 feet. Of course, there's no testimony about this, but I think once you get to the refuge alternative, there is a certain amount of time, I think, that where it has to be deployed. There's in the regulations, it talks about being trained in deploying it. So it's not something I think you can just jump into. There are things that have to be done. So that's critical time where I guess noxious gases can overcome somebody, especially if you're... There's some testimony about the SCSRs and the limited time, 20 minutes for the one, I guess, on you. Um, uh, I don't find the SCSR testimony, I think, really critical here, and I don't think anyone here does. But to me, the possibility of injured minors, in particular, leads me to conclude that the judge was correct in finding S&S.
May I push back a little?
Sure.
Yes. First of all, I want to assure you, Chairman, that if we have an emergency here, I won't leave until I get you out. Commissioners follow the same rule as minors.
I know.
You're right across from the exit. Your office is right across.
Actually, I might not get
out of the building.
No,
you're going to go back and get it? That's admirable.
All three of you guys are on your own. But I might get Mary Lou.
Yeah.
Anyway, first of all, I want to compliment Commissioner Cohen for not bringing up his pivotal role in the movement of the significant and substantial test over the years. I mean, the circuit courts have been building off of commission decisions, and I think he's the grandfather of this case law that he's referencing, and I think he should take credit for it, or discredit for it, as the case may be. I would point out that his Matthews analysis, his Knox Creek analysis, left out one paragraph, or one or two paragraphs, where the court said Knox Creek attempts, for example, to paint a doomsday picture, arguing that the Secretary's interpretation will result in designating every permissibility violation as S&S, or that would result in effectively changing Matthew's reasonable likelihood of occurrence to a simple could occur. First, even under the Secretary's interpretation, the third Matthews prong still requires evidence, it doesn't say that three times, evidence that the hazard is reasonably likely to result in an injury-producing event. Where is the evidence here? I read the decision we're making today, at least as it's framed by the chairman, acting chairman, and Commissioner Cohen, as really established, it clearly establishes per se at 110 feet. It's per se at 110 feet, as far as I can see. I mean, you don't cite anything that would, other than that it's 110 feet. So I don't know how you're ever going to start moving that down, moving that down under the analysis you've come up with today. So the problem I have with that is that gets to the first part of me. That makes it per se, and yet regulatory authorities, people who are experts in this, Illinois has a 3,000-foot refuge chamber requirement. Did Illinois not take into account worst-case scenarios when they established 3,000 feet? Did they think everything would be hunky-dory, that explosions wouldn't affect the mine? No. Any rational person, it's clear MSHA took into account that miners might be injured, there'd be dust and smoke. I didn't go through the NIOSH report in sufficient detail to tell you today that they took that into account. But it's inconceivable to me that they didn't take it.
I think the NIOSH...
And they had many studies behind what they...
Prepared. NIOSH was concerned about an explosion at the face injuring a refuge chamber that was too close.
Well, that's why they didn't want it too close. Right.
And I think MSHA dealt with that in a technical way in terms of its specs for the refuge chamber.
But they certainly thought, when they put 2,000 feet in there, that 2,000 feet would be a satisfactory distance.
Maybe.
Metal, non-metal.
Maybe.
Non-metal, not metal, non-metal. Well, for a regulation, that was their suggestion. Metal, non-metal, or their actual suggestion was 30 minutes, which is presumably much farther than 1,000 feet. The metal, non-metal goes 30 minutes. So the notion that it's a per se violation to go 110 feet beyond 1,000, I think is, there's no reason to say that. What is the reason to say that other than you're afraid? And a fear is a good thing to have in a mining environment. But we are reducing Matthews to under a, not only there's an emergency, but then there's a very slim particular type of emergency that we have no evidence could even occur. No evidence before. To me, this is just a burden of proof case. I clearly could have found the significant and substantial if some evidence was in the record, but there's no evidence in the record. And I don't think we do a service to anybody by affirming decisions where the secretary hasn't proved the case. Hey, Commissioner Cohen's been one of the leading advocates of having the solicitor prove their cases. And I completely agree with him. And he did; they just didn't put in any evidence in this case.
What would have been sufficient for you?
Hmm?
What evidence would be sufficient for you?
They could have put in seam height. They could have put in water conditions. They could have put in. They could have put in that there actually was a history of methane ignitions. They said it, but they didn't put any evidence of it in.
But if the seam height was 8 foot, straight shot, roof conditions okay, would you be per se not SNS?
No, not per se. I'm never per se not SNS. That's why I don't like the 10% test. As I said, it could be 30 feet too far away. And if there's evidence that 30 feet, created a hazard reasonably likely to result in an injury-producing event, I would definitely find it SNS. I just don't see the evidence that this 110 feet, which was the violation, all respect to the Musser sentence, that hazard is reasonably likely to result in an injury-producing event. With all respect, you are going on possibly, could, I can imagine circumstances. This is different than Knox, where we took the opening being too wide could allow methane to escape and set off an explosion, because there the explosion clearly is reasonably likely to harm people. This is like past. We've gone past now, assuming the existence of an emergency. Now we're into the reasonably likelihood of this hazard or this violation creating reasonably likely. It could. I'm not saying it couldn't. I'm not saying 100 that an explosion couldn't have, this 110 feet couldn't have been critical, but I don't see how anybody's proved that it's reasonably likely to be critical.
I'm going to disagree with you on something.
Really?
You've said there's no evidence, and there is evidence here, and there's evidence of the type and quantum that we've approved of. You know, an inspector's testimony standing on its own has been accepted in some contexts as an expert testimony. It's been accepted as evidence of conditions. It's valid evidentiary support.
It's valid, but it's not expert. This testimony is not expert.
I didn't say this testimony was necessarily expert, but I'm just saying when you look at what an inspector's testimony is, it's something that is routinely relied on by administrative law judges, and the standard for substantial evidence is such evidence as a reasonable mind would find firm enough to convince him the truth or absence of the fact that it's offered to prove. In this case, you have an inspector who's talking about conditions in the mine. The judge can credit or not credit his experience or his understanding of those conditions. When you talk about the methane, it may or may not be a fact of what the methane levels were, or where they were read, or what it was at the face, but it's a fact that they were on spot inspections. You don't get there unless you got a gassy mine, unless you're liberating excess methane. You have the spot inspections for a reason. Getting down to the reason of why we do things, you look at the facts argued about in this case, the inspector says, after you go 1,000 feet, you're tired. Common sense supports that. So there's evidence that says, after you go 1,000 feet, you're tired. When the inspector says, there's going to be confusion and chaos and disorientation in those circumstances, the worst case scenario, I think we've all agreed that's what you're going to get down to.
Did the inspector say you're not reasonably likely to be able to go another 100 feet?
What does the inspector know about reasonably likely?
Of course, that's the whole point. He doesn't know anything.
No, he's talking about, circumstances in a mine-wide disaster. He thought it'd be too far in the conditions of this mine. The judge credited his testimony. When you look at what he's talking about, you get to the end of that 1,000 feet. You've gone 1,000 feet in a mine disaster. Congratulations. Probably people are injured. It's been a terrible explosion because both of your escapeways are not available.
That's the gravamen of the standard, right? Everybody's assumed that in setting the standard.
I'm somebody who's said a couple of things and has been real hard on a couple of things about the law. One is that, you know, the way things are written, that they are written, that Congress has acted or the Secretary has acted and gone through the rulemaking process matters. It matters a lot. When you're talking about a life and death situation, escape from a mine disaster is a life and death situation. The fact that Congress handed off to the secretary responsibility for deciding what it is, and the secretary said, you know what? We're going with 1,000 feet. It's our expertise.
So you're per se.
They get,
you're
no, I'm not per se.
You are per se.
I'm not per se.
You're crediting an inspector who said 1 foot, 10 people are likely to die.
No,
it's
I said
foot.
That's, I said
you're
that's
crediting the inspector.
I said that's his opinion. His
testimony was ridiculous.
I'm not suggesting that this is the standard that we ought to impose, Commissioner Alton. I'm looking at this as how do we decide what it is? And to me, it's very important that the secretary set a standard. When I say, the other thing I've been hard on, hey, make a rule, give us something hard, give us something firm, don't give us something squishy and ephemeral. They've given us 1,000 feet. 1,000 feet means something here. When you look at the background and the evidentiary support of what was provided for the rulemaking, the things that were cited in the preamble, they talk about the distance being meaningful, about it having some import to the people who decided to set the standard there. When you set it there, everybody's looking at this and like, well, we don't know. We don't know where it becomes too much. Exactly. When Commissioner Cohen says, well, let's get some more cases, we're deciding what the standard is that's going to apply to those cases. What are we going to tell people?
Well, what we've told people, let's be real. We've made any distance per se. Why should we float around saying, well, I could possibly imagine. Come on, guys.
I'm not going to
make. Let's be realistic.
I'm not in favor of making any distance per se. And
well, tell me how you would find it not per se.
How
would you find it not a violation?
How would you find it not a violation? In this case,
not a violation,
not
S&S.
Not S&S in this case?
Maybe if it wasn't a gassy mine.
If the inspector, if the inspector said it was 50 feet, if it was 75 feet, I'd say, you know, that seems kind of trivial. You know, in the context of everything else that's going on, you can't make an argument that fact alone. But when you get out there and you're starting to look at 10% over something.
So now you're using your expertise to say you probably wouldn't go with 60, but that extra
it's not
50,
my, it's
that
not
extra
my expertise.
50 is too much.
It's,
come on.
At some point, there's a line.
There's got to be evidence. All I'm saying is I could find 30.
There is evidence.
An inspector who testified 1 foot is significant and substantial.
That's his belief about the conditions.
So his testimony is not credible as to
the facts were not 1 foot. We're not deciding the case.
No, but
on
I'm talking. You're looking at his testimony.
Per se would
you're
be 1 foot.
You're citing his testimony. His testimony doesn't support anything except per se.
I think his testimony would support the
Come
imposition
on,
of a per se standard.
Right,
no, I'm a textualist. I'm a textualist conservative, and I'm looking at this from the standpoint of a regulatory body that was properly endowed by this power by Congress, drawing a line and saying, this is the line.
Since you're much bigger than me and can beat me up, I'm not going to argue with you anymore.
I'm not inclined to beat anybody up, but I am, and I say this seriously, Commissioner Cohen, with all due respect. You know, I think you're right in your prediction about Knox Creek, but I'm not sure I agree with the Knox Creek decision, and I certainly don't agree with the Black Beauty decision. And the fact that appeals courts make decisions for us, and we look at them, and you're like, well, that's the law, that's what we get. I'm going to obey it, because I think that's the command that I've been given. But that doesn't mean I have to agree with it, and that doesn't mean that appeals courts are always right about the law. I think that you look at Matthews, it's getting pulled pretty far from what was originally intended. And the danger of that, cops and prosecutors, they never look at the unintended consequences. They only want something that's going to help them get a conviction. I had an occasion recently to reread the Miranda decision. And the shocking thing about the Miranda decision, when you look at it now, knowing what we know, you got kids on the street, they don't know who Joe Biden is. Adults on the street who don't know what Joe Biden is. But they all know who Miranda, they all know Miranda. They can recite it. Everybody in the country knows it. But at the time, it was a radical, close case. It was viewed as the fall of civilization, as the death knell brought by an activist court. Now everybody loves it. You know who loves it the most? Cops. Because you can play your cop games, you can do what cops have always done, but as long as you follow that rule, which is a bright, clear thing that's been set out, then you're good.
Well, not entirely. I will tell you sometime of the confession I reversed.
Well,
where the guy was Miranda.
I'm not saying that you're necessarily always good, but people.
Mary Lou would be banging her gavel at this point. She'd be banging that gavel down really hard.
Everybody loves Miranda in practice. Civil libertarians have reasons to like Miranda. I know that there are always people who are going to dislike something about something. But when you look at the situation. That's what you have. And I'm looking at this situation and saying, okay, we've got a limit. We've got a hard limit that's been given to us. If we're going to say, well, okay, it's per se, S&S, maybe. I'm saying we don't have to. On this record, it's a close call, and I'm not sure how I'm going to make that call. I think Commissioner Nakamura has made some compelling arguments for saying this is just a substantial evidence, traditional Matthews case. I think that Commissioner Alton has made some compelling evidence or arguments that say, despite my disagreement with you about whether there's no evidence or not no evidence, it's weak evidence. It's not especially strong from an evidentiary standpoint.
Yeah, it's a burden of proof case.
And it may be a burden of proof case. So I'm not decided how I would look down on this and how I'm ultimately going to decide it. But I, you know, I have some concerns here because there has to be some solidity and regularity in the law and the way it comes about and the way it's imposed. And what I've suggested maybe isn't solid, maybe it's not regular. But when you look at the bigger picture, what I'm trying to do is find a way to preserve the case law and not irreparably damage Mathis as a tool and an analytical tool that people can regularly apply, and not at the same time disregard a duly promulgated standard that means something in this context. Under the facts of this case, which is not 1 foot, and it's not 20 feet, it's not 25 feet, nor is it 2,000 feet. It's 1,110 to 1,125 feet, somewhere in there. So I'm not sure how I'm going to come out with that, but that's what's going to motivate me in making my decision.
I want to respond to what you said about the Fourth Circuit maybe not being right in Knox Creek. One thing we tend to overlook is that Section 104D1 uses the language, violation is of such nature as could significantly and substantially contribute to the cause and effect of a coal or other mine health hazard. We tend to overlook Congress's use of the word could.
I think that's a valid point. A lot of water under the bridge before I got here, interpreting it the way it's been interpreted.
Well, nobody's called anybody a name yet, so we might as
well. I think we'll have some interesting discussions as we go forward, so stay tuned.
Nobody has the chairman's proxy, right? Nobody knows.
No. She'll have to. Any questions? You need anything from us?
I'll follow up at some future point.
Okay.
Well, you said how to write the decision. Right now, I'd be a little mystified, too.
All right. Well, thank you. Case is submitted. We'll go off the record.